podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It's the weekend and it's Lizzie Doyle. I'm in the hot seat today. Joining me, I've got Claire Brookfield, I've got Cam Rimmer, I've got Craig Hannon and I've got Kev Walsh. Coming up on today's show, we're going to talk about the match last night against Arsenal. We've got Andy Heaton talking to Kieran Maguire, who you'll know from the Price of Football podcast. They're getting stuck into the Man City FFP case and all the details there. And then part three, we've got a lovely little segment coming up, which is Connor Phillips, who you'll know from our Finding a Footy Fix video. He's speaking to a couple of Irish Liverpool fans who you might know, in Gav Doyle and Steve Brown, about Jack Charlton and about the influence he had on Ireland. And yeah, just basically a little bit of a tribute to the man. And then in the last part, we're all going to talk about the transfer window and how the fact it is now open till October. But we're going to start off looking at the match last night. And I'll start with you, Kev. I mean, it was the darkest day in Liverpool's history. it was worse than Stoke 6-1. I felt like we got relegated looking at social media and the reaction from a lot of people last night. But I think now that we're a day later, the post-match show was always very emotional and stuff. Like, let's reflect and let's get a bit of perspective. The Reds are champions. We lost. It's okay to be disappointed, but still made up that we're champions as well.
No one's allowed to be disappointed. The little famous fridges. We just won the league for the first time in 30 years. I'm not asked one. Honestly, the carry-on yesterday on fucking Twitter was absolutely embarrassing. It was so pathetic. Listen, the 100-point record or whatever would have been a lovely little trinket to put on the top of the season, but I haven't been dreaming about 100 points for the last 30 years. I've been dreaming about winning the league, and we finally won the league. So people need to get over themselves. And all honestly, the carry-on out of some people yesterday was a fucking joke. I hope people have a little read back through what they were putting on the likes of Twitter last night and just cringe their heads off. Like I do when I'm bladdered and I go on there and the next day go on and just delete my stuff. Like, oh, what have I done here? I hope loads of people do that from last night and just think, if you're not enjoying this, we're literally going to lift the league title next week. They're putting a big fucking podium on the car so that Kenny Dalglish can give Jordan Henderson the title for the first time in 30 years and people are not happy. Listen, you're in it for the wrong reasons if you're not happy for me.
I mean, we don't want to go on about the likes of like Twitter and that too much. It was just because it did seem so like raw last night. And just dead quickly again, Kev, after editing all the special shows, I come across a lot of overviews with you on and speaking to Rob. And we had Rob Gutman's wise words saying, stop being spoiled little brats about how you win a league. And I feel like that message should really be what we should take with us now, that we've won a league, we've got what we wanted. Yet it is a shame that we're not going to get the record because of how good this team is, but look what they've done for us.
Exactly, yeah. So they've given us what literally, well, that was one of the best days of my life the other week. It genuinely was one of the best couple of days of my life. And it's what I've been dreaming about when going to match for literally 30 years. I'm 36, so I was alive last time in the league, but I don't remember it. And in 30 years' time, when I'm telling my kids and grandkids or whoever, what's going to have gone on then? I'm not going to be talking about, oh, yeah, after the league title, we didn't win a game or we won one game or whatever it is. I'll be like, it was unbelievable. We won the league, we weren't even playing, and it was still fantastic because it was the first time in 30 years. And listen, that's what I'm in it for, and maybe I'm in it for different reasons to other people, but last night doesn't take any shine out of the league title for me.
Craig, do you think it's a case of that we're victims of our own success? You know, before the lockdown happens, we've only been beaten once. The season before that, we were only beaten once. We've set our own bar so high that people have just got used to this Liverpool side being as good as they are. And the fact that the second the league is won, that slight percentage, that natural percentage drop off, which is ever so slight, but clearly makes a difference to this Liverpool side. Do you think that's the case? Do you think that's why people maybe are a bit more emotional about it, because it's right now, it's raw, but like Kev said, when we look back on it, it's probably something we won't really speak about?
Maybe. I mean, I understand that we want to win every game, that like as football fans, we're greedy and we should be greedy. That's healthy. We want to win everything. We want to set records. We want to lift as many trophies as possible. But I think you're right. We're used to watching this side beat everyone, and we're used to this side not letting us down. In the past 2 years, when it's mattered, this side hasn't let us down once. It took them all the way to the last game last season. They win the European Cup, then they do what they do this year. I think in terms of like the manners of the draws and defeats, they're a bit annoying and they can be seen as a bit disappointing. But like, look at the bigger picture here and look at the context, and along the same lines as what Kev said, like, this Liverpool side have done something that 29 Liverpool sides in a row couldn't do. They couldn't achieve it. They've hit their objective, and their objective at the start of the season wasn't to hit 100 points or 101 points or become Centurions. What does Centurions, just a marketing word, it's just been created for marketing by Man City. It means nothing. It's not tangible. You don't lift a trophy because you've hit 101 points. You lift a trophy because you've won the Premier League. And because they've done it in the manner that they have, and because they've hit the objective so early, it's meant that these games mean nothing. And so what that means then, it means that TV companies then, the media, have to create another story. They have to create another narrative around, well, what are we going to talk about? What are we going to talk about before the game? What's Martin Tyler going to discuss with Jamie Carragher, Gary Neville, Jurna, and what's Jeff Shreve's going to ask Jurgen Klopp about afterwards? Right, it's the points total. It's just been created, like, it's been created for a story so that they have something to talk about. And, like, I was thinking about like the years of growing up and having to watch United lift Premier League title after title, and watching Roy Keane and Gary Neville and Steve Bruce and so on a match of the day doing that, and not once was the points total mentioned, and not once I can't remember one points total of Man United, but what I can remember is I can remember the feeling of having to watch them lift that every year, and the feeling of sort of wondering, you know, is that ever going to happen for us? Are we ever going to get to see Liverpool? Is Jamie Redknapp, is Sammy Hupia, is Steven Gerrard, is Jordan Henderson ever going to do this? And are we ever going to get that feeling? And I think as well, like, on the points total, I'm just not going to allow it to discredit what Liverpool have done this season, and I'm not going to allow it to sort of change my feelings around it or sort of taint it in any way. Like, I've seen a few people saying, "Oh, it's taking the shine off it." That's what Jurgen Klopp said earlier in the season. Was he said, "We'll feel how we want to feel when it happens." And so, if you're going to allow something that the media have created for their own narrative, something that, I mean, it's just the latest in a long list of things that opposition fans have tried to use to taint Liverpool's title or to come up with something that discredits it in some way, whether it was VAR, whether it was an asterisk, null and void, you know, it just continues and continues. So basically what I'm saying is that it's okay to feel disappointed, but with the bigger picture and with everything in mind, and with the fact that Van Dijk's never let us down, Alisson's never let us down, and the things that they've achieved in the last 2 years especially, you know, give them these, because it's just pre-season meaningless games. And whenever it does matter, and whenever whenever they do have to sort of stand up and be counted, they will.
I mean, Claire, it's almost like these set of lads are actual human beings, isn't it? That do make mistakes, that do naturally think, oh, like, I can't be bothered. I mean, I've heard so many different analogies over so many shows. I've done, like, a mad marathon one about training for a marathon for 2 years, and then the next minute you've got to go and do a 5K and you can't be arsed doing it. Do you know what I mean? It's a natural thing, isn't it, that there's going to be an ever so slight drop-off. And Craig's there talking about, like, being tainted and taking the shine off. Liverpool are on 93 points. They've won the league with 7 games to go and could finish the season on 99 points. Their best ever points total in history. How on earth can you be disappointed with that?
No, I don't think you can. I'm in a football WhatsApp group and there was loads of people saying similar. They were disappointed. But, you know, I'm 38. I never thought, you know, I'd get to see this again. You can't take what they did last season, winning a European Cup, Super Cup. We've got everything that we ever dreamed of and more. And to me, you know, the way I look at those games where we've dropped points, that City game was never a 4-0 if you watched it. You know, we were totally in that game. Burnley, disappointing. Burnley did well. Last night, we should have absolutely tonked Arsenal, but we made 2 mistakes. I don't think those mistakes happen if Jordan plays, if I'm honest. That was my one thing I think would have been the difference. But I don't think we look like we're on our holidays. I've watched games at the end of the season when you can quite clearly see they're dreaming of getting on a plane. At no point in those games did I think that they don't care. They genuinely did. I mean, Bobby Firmino hits the edge of the post. You know, I mean, everything Salah seemed to touch just bounced in the wrong place. It just was one of those games. But I think Craig's right. It's a narrative for Sky. It's something for the City Twitter brigade to go absolutely mental at. And as petty as it is, I really don't want them to win the Champions League. And I saw Paul Dickoff's tweet today saying, it's really hard to get 100 points. Yeah, how many European Cups have you got? You know, it's just football banter, isn't it, at the end of the day? But I definitely do not want to see them lift that Champions League this year.
I mean, Claire's right, isn't she, Cam, that they did play, they were trying. You know, I mean, I don't think any of us would be that bothered if they'd done a Wayne Rooney and were running around the pitch pissed, because could you really blame them at the end of the day? But they're not. They were trying, and it was two mistakes that gifted Arsenal that win. I mean, Arsenal had three shots to Liverpool's 24. They created one in like the last couple of minutes, but the other two were from our mistakes. Liverpool didn't play all that bad. There's nothing to be too worried about, is there?
No, not at all. And to be honest, you've got to look at this team the way last season we went all the way to the final day of the season going for the league. We had Madrid. Season before that, you've got Kiev. Season before that, you're going for the top four to the end of the season. They're going to be mentally and physically knackered, aren't they? So you've got to give them these last couple of games. And to be honest, as you said, the performances haven't even been that bad. I mean, Van Dijk and Alisson, one in a million mistakes, and then they're gifted goals. Because in that first half of the first half, it was like a training session, weren't it? They were playing it around their 18-yard box for some reason, hoofing it up, was going on the attack. And I just thought that was going to be the case all night, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, you've got to let them off. I mean, look at the moments they've gave us these last couple of years. It's the humans, aren't they? Like, they're not robots. They're not designed to be 100% every game. So yeah, I've got no complaints about what's happening.
And the thing what you just said there, Cam, about them not being robots and they're not designed to do that just shows what an amazing achievement it is that they've done what they've done, pushing themselves to the limits physically and mentally.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think if we were still in the Champions League, had won the League Cup, still in the FA Cup, maximum points, there still would have been room for someone to have a go or over something. That's just the way it is. That's just how football Twitter is when it comes to Liverpool, to be honest. I mean, I think if it was Man City who'd won a Champions League and then gone on to win the league, would have been talked about one of these greatest ever sides, but people are still finding room to have a go at us. And to be honest, all that should do is, that should be Klopp's team talks for next season, to just say, let's go shut them up even more, let's just bounce back and show them that we're not just, you know, here for the numbers sort of thing.
Yeah, no, you're right, you're absolutely right. And it does seem to be a bit of a echo chamber, doesn't it? But just on the match then, Kev, obviously we get the goal, Liverpool look really good up until, again, it seems to keep coming up, the first water break, it's now played in quarters. So Liverpool looked on top, didn't they? And then obviously the Virgil mistake comes and you know, Arsenal equalise and sort of get a little bit, they get lucky, don't they?
Yeah, that is all it is for Arsenal, they do just get lucky. I think if without one of those mistakes last night, and in particular without Virgil's mistake, you'd probably see Liverpool go on to win 3-4, 5-0 maybe. But the problem you've got is, and the reason why it's happening to us at the moment is, we start off well against Man City, as Claire said before. We start off fantastically last night. I thought, wow, we're really on it here. But the difference is there's no need for us, or not no need, because that makes them sound unprofessional. But when something goes wrong, they haven't got to dig into the reserves like they did have to. When you think back on this season, you think about games like Aston Villa, where we're 1-0 down after 87 minutes and we win 2-1. And if we'd done that, because if we didn't win there and City had won the following day, it was something like they were level on points or they were 3.5 or whatever it was. But having that motivation to then kick in again once you've made the mistake is what makes a football team like Liverpool, and like any team really that are going for the league, go again in a game. Whereas in a game like last night, they're like, oh, this is sound. And if it had all kept on going sound, they'd have just carried on doing that. But when something went wrong, it'd give Arsenal a bit of a geo. Instead of going like, right, let's go again, Liverpool are a bit like, well, that was a bit mad, wasn't it? And they're probably, you see, Virgil van Dijk last night after a match, I thought in his interview, he was on the verge of laughing. And he would not have been like that had he made that mistake before we'd won the league. He'd have been absolutely furious with himself. And I'm not even sure you would have seen him do the interview. So you've got to remember the human beings, and they've already done exactly what we asked of them to do this season. Now, anything else, as I say, is at stake. But the game itself, I thought we played really well. We'd obviously targeted their right-hand side, Andy Robertson, and I thought he was absolutely fantastic. So Bobby Firmino in the first half just showed exactly why he's Bobby Firmino and why he's so useful to us, because he was playing in the number nine role, but he just kept dropping into that little area. And his way to pass is a thing of absolute beauty. That touch he gives into Robertson for the goal is just fantastic. And all these things are probably why people were frustrated later on when we couldn't break them down second half. but it's because you're not going at 100%. And I think all the way it looked last night, the way it looked against City for the first 20 minutes, the way it looked against Burnley for the first half, to be fair as well, all bode well for next season. And if we can hopefully, if FSG finds some pennies down the back of the couch, buy another couple of players and freshen the squad up, it looks good again for us for next season. I don't think people need to be thinking about the second half of these games where we've dropped off a little bit and thinking, oh, this is really going to affect next season. What will affect next season is the 90% of the season you've already seen from us. And when we go again next year, that's what you'll see. You won't be watching them playing where Virgil van Dijk is gifting goals and Arsenal's gifting goals, because they haven't done that before and they won't do it again when they're back in the game.
Yeah, you can't force it, can you, Craig? And this is the thing, I mean, the second goal goes in. Alisson, again, the fella who I haven't seen really make a mistake like that since, I think it was Leicester away, weren't it? About a season ago, a season or two ago. I can't remember when it was off the top of my head. But there was a slight complacency there. And I think Klopp said it in his post-match press conference. He went to Sky, went to the tell, and he said, we switched off. And he didn't have to embellish. There was nothing else. He just said, we switched off. It wasn't that we didn't want it enough. It's not that we didn't play well enough. There was just a lapse in concentration that cost us the game. Arsenal then sat back, like Kev said, and don't forget, like, Arsenal as well, they're preparing for an FA Cup semi-final against Man City, who play obviously in a similar sort of attacking way. They were probably sticking a bit of practice in for that game as well, and you know, they sorted out the game, and to be honest, they didn't deserve the 3 points, but it happens in football, doesn't it?
I think we had something like 16 shots and they had two. And they scored
24-3. It was.
Was it 24 as much as that? So yeah. I just remember sort of it coming up, and they basically had scored from every chance. Like, I'm struggling to remember another chance that they had beyond the two mistakes. And I mean, Alisson said it in his own his own interviews, and I thought that was interesting actually, that the two players that were put up were Van Dijk and Alisson. That just sort of shows the mentality that they'll not hide away, that they know that when they make mistakes, they'll sort of stand and tell you sort of why. And Alisson said, I'm human. And I think what we've sort of alluded to there is what they have achieved is maybe this is just a little reminder that they are human, and because of the last sort of 2 years of what they have achieved, we've sort of forgotten that they can make mistakes. That Alisson, the best goalkeeper in the world, can make a mistake now and then. Van Dijk as well. It just doesn't happen very often. That there'll be people listening to this that will want us to get stuck in, and there'll be people that'll be listening to this and, you know, they'll want us to fume over the result or whatever. And I'm sorry that I'm not going to do that, and seemingly no one else is going to do that. But I think that when you look at the bigger picture and you think about even look at the result last night, and even look at the nature of the game, the nature of the game was so sort of pre-season that even when we were the better team in the first 20 minutes, it still felt sort of slow and a bit passive. And it looked like a football team that had already won the league and were playing in a big empty stadium, and that's what it looked like. And it's just to try and sort of find negatives and to try and delve into what's gone wrong and what might go wrong in the future. I think Kev's absolutely spot on, and that, you know, that whatever happens in the next two games and what's happened in the sort of previous four or five games won't dictate the success of this Liverpool side in the future.
No, you're right. And just to put all that into context as well, that's Virgil van Dijk's second goal conceded from a mistake in 88 games. That's nearly 2 years. So that just goes to show you, do you know what I mean? If it's going to happen once in 2 years, I'll take that all day, any day. Cam, just on the positives then, like I say, we played quite well up until, I'd say probably the first half. There was some good performances again. Like I say, some really good things to be taken from it. But just want to quickly touch on the substitutions. I mean, Naby Keita comes on, Minamino both come on, and they played really well. I think they changed the game, and everyone was sort of asking why Naby wasn't starting. Oxlade-Chamberlain gets in, who I don't think's been in great form at all since lockdown. And Naby Keita comes on and sort of, you know, puts his hands up again and says, look, boss, it's giving him another excuse to play him again, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, all the players who don't, like, put themselves in the starting 11, all these games now are just trying to warrant to start for next season, aren't they, really? Trying to play into the starting 11 for the first game of next season. But yeah, I thought when them two came on, I thought Minamino, like, I was really impressed, and when he came on, I thought he really went for it. He looked a lot more positive than he has done in recent weeks, and he looked a lot more confident as well, which is only a good thing. And as well, yeah, with Naby Keita as well, thought he was pulling the strings as well. I mean, obviously only short cameo appearances, but yeah, I mean, these players who aren't in the starting 11, this is their time to show now, isn't it? Obviously you've got the transfer window coming up, wherever that brings, nobody knows. So these players now need to, these all want to be part of this brilliant team, don't they, for when it all comes back next season. So yeah, I think they had a good game. I've got no complaints with either of them, to be honest.
No, and I think there's not necessarily anyone who had a terrible game either, Claire, but there was also a very, very rare appearance for Jadon Shaqiri last night. I was quite surprised to see him come on, Divock Origi as well. And I think when Origi come on, obviously, I think Minamino's performance was affected because they had to sort of change formation again. But, I mean, in the nicest way possible, like, it was a little bit of a drop-off, wasn't it, if you look at the bench to the first 11. But, I don't know, what did you make of Shaqiri coming on?
Well, I didn't think we'd ever see him again. I thought he's another Adam Lallana that we'd be saving. He's obviously out the door as far as I'm concerned, so was really surprised to see him. He's had an unfortunate form. I would have brought Harvey Elliott on. You know, A, he needs the appearances. He's a kid with nothing to lose. He would have been my substitute personally. Maybe they were just putting Shaqiri in the shop window to say he's fit, and if anyone's interested, come and get him. But I do definitely agree that the game changed with the substitutes. But just going back to like that pre-season feel, I think the empty stadium is a massive play in all of this. And my only concern for next season is, when do we get back? Because that is what is our biggest play, is our home support and our away support. And I think that is the concern, that when they really need us, yeah, I know they can do it themselves, but we are the 12th man, and that would be my only worry, that, you know, that roar of the cop when the time of need isn't going to be there. And that's the thing I worry about for next season. Not the players, not Klopp, but not having any fans in the stadium.
I was really excited to sort of see Shaqiri, by the way. And I don't know why. He's just one of those footballers that, like, I just think something a bit mad might happen. He'll bring a bit of madness to the game. He's a real, like, sort of moments footballer, isn't he? And with his new hair especially, like, yeah, smashing with his new hair. He's done a good job there, fair play.
I think,
like, Keita as well. Like, Keita has done himself no harm throughout all of this. And you sort of saw immediately he was doing all of the things that, like, I want Oxlade-Chamberlain to do more of, that, you know, like breaking the lines and being that man sort of between the midfield and the attack and sort of driving at the Arsenal defence. That's something that in Chamberlain's first season in the second half before he got injured, we saw loads of, and that was like the encouraging thing about him. And that's what I sort of really enjoyed about him. And we haven't really seen that. I'm left watching and worrying and sort of thinking, well, what is he doing at the moment? And I know that feels very, very harsh, but I think whenever you bring on someone like Keita and you see what he's doing, suddenly he lifts the game and sort of elevates those around him, and he's making things happen. And then you sort of you see the difference between the two. And and you know, as Cam said, Minamino as well hasn't, you know, he didn't do him any sort of he done himself all the favors last night in terms of the little drop of the shoulder and finding space and hitting just wide. I'll be interested to see how he sort of progresses and pushes on in the next two games.
Yeah, and last one to you, Kev, then. As we've just clearly finished on many more positives than there are negatives, we keep going back to this perspective thing, but you do need to keep hold of it. I mean, we're days away from watching Jordan Henderson lift the trophy, probably on crutches. God love you, fella. You know, Pyro going off on the ground. Yeah, okay, we can't be there, but we're about to have the picture, the moment, the scene that we've been dreaming of our captain lifting the Premier League trophy. I mean, if you would have said to anyone at the start of this season, you're going to win the Premier League with 7 games to go, but guess what? You're going to lose to Arsenal and City after you've won it, and you're going to watch Jordan Henderson lift the trophy at Anfield, we would have taken it all day anyway, wouldn't we?
I think people were saying he would willingly give us thumbs on Anfield's rap show to see us win the league.
There was body part involved, yeah.
There was a little body part getting given up to see us win the league, and I was well in for that. So listen, everyone knows how much I hate Everton. I just thought getting beat 10-0 by Everton to win the league, I'm not asked, you know what I mean? People need to get that bit of perspective back in. And listen, hopefully, as I said before, people are a bit raw after a match and everyone wants to have an opinion straight away, fair play. But I think next week, even if we get beat by Chelsea, which I don't think we will, I think they'll probably turn on for that game. But like, we're gonna see what we've been waiting for 30 years to see. When Henderson lifts up, the only problem's going to be, as you say, if he is on crutches, he can't do his little shuffle, can he?
It might just be adapted.
Right, well, I imagine he'll come up with something because he listens. He's the man for the big occasion, isn't he? So I'm sure he'll come up with something for that as well.
That long
he needs to get some injections or something, doesn't he, to make that happen? They need to give him some painkillers and, like, as if it's like a proper match he's going
to
play.
We're not asking him to play 90 minutes, are we? It's only a couple of seconds.
Depends how heavy it is. Don't forget James Milner's injured. It's going to be like 2 hour fellas, like, trotting up to the cop, taking about half an hour to get up there. But listen, however it's done, it's going to be a moment we remember. So, let's all just keep that in mind, eh? Let's just remember what this team's done and remember that we are the happiest fans in England right now because we're still the champions of England. Coming up in the next part then, it is Andy Heaton with Kieran Maguire talking about Man City and their FFP case and all the stuff that came out about that earlier this week.
Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons with you to talk about Amelia Bonner and the work that she's been doing for the Standard Chartered Sound Red Soundboard. It's a bit of a mouthful, that one, Amelia, but I'm sure you've been doing a fabulous job on the soundboard.
I've got to do that every game, and I just about manage it.
Have you enjoyed it immensely? Because whenever I've seen all the clips stuff I've seen and watching back a couple of them, it looks as though everyone's had a lot of fun.
Oh, it's a lovely time. I do always look forward to it. When I know that I'm down for one of the games, I look forward to it a bit more because it's obviously not like being in the ground, but hearing the sounds is really different to when you watch the match at home. You've got the option of silence or generic crowd noise. It just isn't quite the same. And it's the same as when you go and watch it in a pub now that they're open. You can just see the empty stands and there's something a bit different about kind of hearing the noises that you recognise with it. And also having Jamie there is dead nice because he gets really into it and is having a sing along, and it feels like you're with your mates even though you can't be.
That's the way in which it's gone. I've seen that Jamie seems to be having an absolute ball at times, and it does look as though it's endlessly exuberant, I think it's fair to say.
Oh yeah, it's confirmed for me what I already knew, which is that Jamie Webster must be a very good pint. If that's how excited he is when he's not allowed to drink anything and we're there in the studio doing it, then I bet he's a lot of fun on and away. But it's been great doing it with him. And he knows his stuff about everything from chance to what's going on the pitch. So it's been nice to get to do that with him. But it is really good fun. And they've added more chants as it's gone on. So getting to listen to new ones as it's happening is good.
What are your favourite hits then, Amelia? What are you throwing on?
My favourite hits, getting the Virgil one was a big, big moment for us because that we've gotten to use it a bit more. The Bobby one, the names player chants are good because they're the ones that you'd usually be singing in the ground. Jamie's really good at doing the first couple of chants that you'd have after kickoff. He always gets those bang on. But my favourite one's Poetry in Motion, and Mo said the same, and Aldo said the same, and Jason McAteer said the same. So basically, I'm in good company.
Yeah, you've got some solid mates there. You're doing the one. You're going to do the game on Wednesday night, and that means that you're going to actually get to do the trophy lift. And that's something that just sort of struck me as really interesting. And when we originally talked about all of this, I didn't really clue the trophy lift in. And as Liverpool have decided, it's going to be an absolutely super duper one hell of a production, Busley Barkley vibes, the full hit from a Liverpool point of view. You're going to get to soundtrack that, and that to me just sounds like a load of fun.
It does. I mean, there's quite a bit of pressure on Jamie there, though. Imagine saying to someone, you've got to single-handedly create the atmosphere that we would expect to have had in Anfield when we lifted the Premier League trophy for the first time in 30 years. Good luck with that, Jamie. but he's really good at it. As it's gone on, he always says every week, he's like, I'm getting better at this, you know, and he's good at kind of like building up the atmosphere and doing the right reactions and things. So I've got no doubt that when it actually comes to the lift, he'll be all over it. And then on the screen, we'll have our version of, you know, when towns accidentally let off all the fireworks at the same time, like they've got a firework display and they're just like, oh god, we pressed all the buttons at once. That's what I'm imagining it'll look like on the car.
I think it's going to be absolutely spectacular. It's you know, it's obviously the results haven't quite been what we'd all want, to be honest with you, Amelia, and that also is a thing. It's a thing to sort of bear in mind as we're going through this. But the one thing you can say for certain is how unbelievably excited everyone's going to be when that trophy gets lifted up. It is going to be an absolutely brilliant moment. In fact, I'll go to you first on it, John, really. I've only really properly engaged with this the last 48 hours when I've seen them pulling bits of the cop out in order to pull it all together. And then as the news is sort of breaking around it, it is stupefyingly exciting, in fact.
I love how excited all the players are as well. Like all the social media after the game was, oh, that was a shame, wasn't it? But hey, trophy next week. Which I just love. I love the fact that they're all buzzing off it and it's the thing that they're looking forward to, and that's great. And, you know, it's going to be a brilliant moment, and obviously there's a lot of planning on it. You want to make it a spectacular thing, so it's going to look boss on the telly.
I was hugely entertained, John, by the fact that the fire proofed all the banners.
Important.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Lads and lasses work hard on them, making them, and you don't want something going up in flames or for a rogue Catherine wheel. So yeah, all good.
Yeah, you got a couple of lads getting too excited with their sparklers as it all goes all the way through. So people can find it, Candy Amelia. It's on YouTube.
It is indeed.
It's on YouTube. It is the Stand Red soundboard on YouTube there. It's on Standard Charter's channel. And you start how long before each game do you start?
We've got about 15 minutes before each match, and then we're there throughout halftime and then afterwards. But if you log on right around the time that it starts, you'll get the extra treat of my mum commenting on the live stream but thinking that she's doing it with a fake name. if you get there early enough, then you'll see her giggling to herself going, oh, she'll never know it's me. She's ever so proud.
Excellent stuff. Well done all around. So, yeah, you can check that out there. Do check it out this Wednesday. It might be a lovely way to enjoy what should be a fabulous moment. Everyone can be together with that. Thank you very much to Amelia. Thank you very much to John. So it is the Standard Chartered Stand Red soundboard. It is on YouTube. If you go to the Standard Chartered YouTube channel, which is the easiest thing in the world to find. And it's at the very top there. Thank you very much indeed. Enjoy it next week.
I am Andy Heaton for the Weekender. I'm delighted to be joined via Zoom by Liverpool University's own Kieran Maguire, friend of the show and football finance expert. We've had Kieran on a couple of times. We thought we'd invite him back because, you know, there might have been something in the news you might have seen over the last 36 hours. Kieran, it must have been a crazy couple of days for you.
Yeah, I did my first interview, which was a pre-record, at 7:30 yesterday morning. I finished at 9:15 on TalkSport, and then I was back on Radio 4 at 6:30 this morning. The phone's not stopped ringing. I always say I wish my job didn't exist, because then we could just concentrate on the football. But sadly, the money side of things, especially given the growth of the game, does get in the way. And I've been kept on my toes the last few days.
And I suppose it doesn't help when Izzy interviewers don't press record at the start of sessions as well. For those, a bit of transparency, we were 10 minutes into this show interview before when I realised that I hadn't pressed record. So thank you again, Kieran, for being patient and putting up with my idiocy. Anyway, before we get into the detail of it, the headlines was Casa's verdict was delivered yesterday morning in regards to Manchester City's case against FIFA, or however you want to phrase it, and resulted with the two-year ban from the European Cup or European competition being lifted, and the fine reduced from €30 million to €10 million. But there's been a lot of headlines, a bit of hysteria and a bit of hubris, shall we say, from certain quarters. Can you explain, Kieran, for those that don't know, and in terms of I don't understand what exactly has happened in the last 36 hours?
Well, the UEFA ban was based on the view that Manchester City had a sponsorship arrangement with Etihad Airways worth £65 million. And that only £8 million of that was coming from Etihad Airways, and the remainder was being supplied by Manchester City's owners. And that wouldn't be allowed for financial fair play purposes, that additional investment. So UEFA took the view that because the money was coming from the owners, it therefore meant that City had misled UEFA and was also in breach of financial fair play rules. And as a consequence of that, they decided upon that the tariff in the form of the two-year ban and the €30 million fine. CAS took a look at the evidence presented by both parties. City had said immediately following the verdict they were going to appeal. I think City's viewpoint that they were being picked upon by the established elite of Europe, and therefore they were sort of parking themselves in a corner and taking on all comers. City took on, I think, 4 or 5 law firms to represent their case, some of the best sports-like lawyers in the country. I've lived in Manchester most of my life. I can assure you half of Manchester is overjoyed and half of Manchester is probably as aggravated as you're feeling at present.
Is it as simple? I mean, I'm not so much aggravated, more fascinated by the whole thing, but is it the case that the perception that City can just act with impunity because they can just throw so much money at these kind of things. Because that seems to be, that's what people are saying. Well, of course they were going to get away with it because, you know, they'll just lawyer up and throw millions and millions and millions at it.
I don't think so. If you take a look at what's happened with City under Sheikh Mansour, certainly in the early years, the amount of spending was off the scale. And they were just throwing money at anything and everything, and it was very hit and miss. Since the introduction of financial fair play, it is evident that City have reined in their spending. It's still at the top end, but then given that they are a top four club, in terms of their position in the table, you'd expect them to have a competitive wage budget and a competitive transfer budget. In terms of their lawyers, the owners, and I think everybody in the management team were very unhappy with the initial verdict. Certainly some of the evidence which has been presented through Football Leaks and through Der Spiegel did not reflect very well on Manchester City at all. You know, it came across as an organisation which did appear to think that it could do what it wants. But in terms of the behaviour, in terms of football spend, it's certainly at the top tier as far as English football is concerned, but it's not excessive compared to its peer group.
So we'll go on to that in a minute, because as you referenced there, this was back in 2013 where the charges have come from, but which leads to what one of the key things in what CAS have already come up with, and we are waiting more information on that. They were saying that some of the evidence was inadmissible, but what's intrigued me is the time barring of evidence. Now, we don't know the specifics of this, but I mean, going by UEFA's own rules, they set a limit of 5 years. So I think it's fairly safe to assume that because the emails and the leaks that UEFA used as evidence were from 2013, people are presuming that's been a factor. How do you think CAS would have considered that? I mean, especially considering these leaks didn't come to light until 2018, which in theory will be within that window, that statute.
Well, I guess it could be that Manchester City's legal team have applied the 5 years to the letter. So potentially an email from February 2013 might have been inadmissible if UEFA's investigation was in June 2018. So we'll have to go and wait to see with regards to that. I think there's a number of issues sort of from the first pronouncement from CAS. It did appear to indicate that there was this time barring issue, and the lawyers, being the professionals that they are, who were forming the three-man committee that made the final judgment, they would have simply parked that information in the same way that a judge would in a normal legal case, although for a juror it's far more difficult to ignore such information. The other comments that came out of CAS was that they felt that the gravitas of the data and the evidence put forward by UEFA didn't warrant the 2 year penalty that was given to Manchester City. And here there's a bit of chicken and egg, because I think a lot of people felt that if City had been given a 1 year ban initially, perhaps that would have been a more appropriate penalty, and perhaps City might have taken it at the time. But the view was taken that because they knew that City were likely to appeal, that UEFA went in with a more severe sentence in the half expectation, given what we've seen come from CAS in the past when appeals have been made, that a 2 year ban would have been reduced to one, and then we'd move on from there. So it is a really tricky one. The amount of data and the amount of evidence that has been put forward by both legal teams has been huge, but the nature of the people who have been sifting through it is that's what they do for a living.
The comms, especially from Manchester City and media sources close to them, they're very loud, communicating very loud, that they've been completely exonerated. Is that the case?
As far as the claim that they have inflated their revenues through other sources, the CAS verdict would appear to say that. There is a second issue in terms of, and I think it was effectively a second charge. The fine was very much related to City's reluctance and unwillingness to cooperate with UEFA. And in respect of that, CAS have partly upheld the viewpoint taken by by the UEFA adjudicating committee. A 10 million euro fine is still a very substantial sum of money. But when you put that up against the potential income that you can generate from a successful Champions League campaign, which if we take a look at Liverpool in 2019, they made over £100 million in TV money. And then you add on sponsors bonuses and match day income on top of that. And we're fairly close to 150 million. So, from City's point of view, if we're realistic, you'd expect City to be in the last 16, in the quarterfinals as a minimum in the Champions League, given the nature of the team. So over a two-year period, we're probably talking somewhere between 200 to 250 million quid is the financial benefit to them of the CAS decision.
Now, I'll just go come away from that onto the actual process. A lot of people are now saying and pitched it against City v UEFA, and it would be the end or the death of FFP. But as you referenced earlier, this case stems from emails from 2013 when City spent a lot of money. Would it be fair to say that, I mean, not that they've worked within FFP, but FFP has, despite what's just happened, reined City spending in and made City aware of what they can and can't do in the intervening period?
Yes, very much so. If you take a look at the growth of Manchester City's spending since the acquisition by Abu Dhabi United, in the first 3 or 4 years, City were losing over £100 million a year on more than one occasion. So the losses were huge in that initial 3 to 4 years. Since the introduction of FFP effectively coming in from around about 2013. And remember, Manchester City were also found guilty of FFP breaches quite a few years ago. And the tariffs at the time, which was a reduction in squad size, a wage cap, City weren't allowed to increase their wage bill for the 2 years before Pep Guardiola became manager. There was also restrictions in terms of transfer spend, in effect. It did mean that the level of spending by the club did decrease. And it meant that it was perhaps on a more level field with the other elite clubs, both domestically and at the top tier in Europe.
So what I find curious is City, not just Man City, but City Group, because there's a bigger group around this. And I always think about it along the lines of these tax evasion schemes with the likes of celebrities have got involved on and stung with the film finance things. Is it not a case that when you've got that much money and you're that big, you can always find some creative way? I mean, you're an accountant by trade, some creative way of circumnavigating, the controls that are put in place. Is it just a case of you're always playing catch up with whoever can afford the best accountants and the best lawyers?
I've taught at HMRC, and one of the things I've learned from talking to the people there is rich people don't pay tax, because with the best will in the world, they employ the best accountants. And as soon as they spot somebody with a lot of talent at the tax authorities, the accountants go and recruit them because the accountants pay better wages. So is there an opportunity for manipulation and transfer pricing and all the spectacularly dull things which make us accountants very, very wealthy and their clients pay low rates of tax? Yes, there are. Am I going to say that Manchester City has abused the rules? No, I'm not. Because again, there's got to be evidence.
I wouldn't dream of it. I would just, for illustrative purposes.
Yeah. Let's take an example. If you take a look at the director's remuneration of all the clubs in the Premier League, that varies between £7 million for Daniel at Spurs to nothing at Manchester City. So Manchester City's board of directors don't get any money whatsoever. If you then take a look at the accounts of the City Group, which includes all of the clubs in New York, in Melbourne, in Mumbai, in Uruguay, and so on, the director's bill there comes to 4 or 5 million. So it does make you wonder. You look at the number of people employed by Manchester City compared to that of Liverpool and Manchester United. City have around about 300 fewer members of staff. Does that mean that those jobs are effectively outsourced to other parts of the City Group? Well, that's what a cynic, that's what a critic of Manchester City would say. I'm not a cynic, of course, but these are the things which which just seem unusual, and therefore, depending upon which side of the fence you are, and it does become a one team versus another issue to a certain extent, and you can see the views of both parties.
So now we've got that the theory out the way. FFP. So I referenced earlier in the interview, mentioned that it was pitched against City versus UEFA and FFP. What do you think now will happen with FFP? Do you think they're going to have to rip it up, keep it as its status quo, or rewrite it? Because it occurred to me that given the ruling, and we've already seen comments from Jose Mourinho and Jurgen Klopp today, it appears a couple of the big clubs aren't happy, not just in England, but in Spain as well. Tebas has already come out and criticised it. Is there a situation where they might try and rewrite FFP and maybe even get stricter controls in, that maybe the likes of Bayern Munich, Liverpool, Manchester United might not have been happy with a couple of years ago, but in light of what's just happened, would now take, if the effect of that was to stop the likes of PSG and Manchester City and whoever just spending with impunity?
I don't think financial fair play will be abandoned totally. And also, there's some other elements of FFP which work extremely well. If you take a look at some of the sanctions which have been given for those clubs that haven't paid players, that for those clubs that haven't paid transfer fees, which are outstanding, UEFA have been really good in respect of things of this nature. I think when you're up against an elite club such as City, who will be employing the best accountants and lawyers in Europe, by all accounts, then it is going to be very difficult to press forward with a case. I don't think it's in Manchester City's interests for financial fair play to be abandoned as well, because we do remember potentially have Newcastle United about to be acquired by Saudi Arabian's PIF. And if FFP is completely abandoned, it means that Newcastle are going to be at that top table. The arguments put forward by the critics of FFP, it's there to stop another Manchester City and another PSG. We know that City and PSG are already at the top table. If we're going to try to create a closed shop, well, one of the methods of doing that is to have some form of financial controls which restricts expenditure.
Is there a parallel universe a couple of years down the line when City are actually railing for UEFA to enforce these controls to stop it, assuming, you know, the Saudi Arabia deal for Newcastle goes through, or you know, a Saudi fund buy, I've got to be careful how we phrase this, a Saudi fund buys another club, because it's easy to forget Saudi Arabia. You think Abu Dhabi are big and Qatar have got money, Saudi Arabia outscale them by a factor of 10-20.
Very much so. So there is a potential, if we live in a completely unregulated environment, as far as some form of financial controls are concerned, is that we have an arms race. And even if you are a club such as Liverpool, which doesn't have a sovereign wealth funds behind it as a benefactor, they get sucked into it because all of a sudden Newcastle come in with an offer for Virgil van Dijk, 150 million, and they offer him, you know, £20 million a year net. And, you know, you end up losing your best players. So it's in nobody's interests, I think, for us to have unfettered spending, because it makes it more difficult for those clubs who are trying to broadly break even. And I've got to include Manchester City in this at present as well, because if you take a look at their accounts, and as you know, I have no life and it's all that I do in my spare time, it is that over the past four seasons, City have broadly broken even, even though, you know, there are a few curiosities in some of those numbers.
Brilliant, Kieran. Thanks very much for coming on. One final question. Do you think this is the end of the matter for this particular case with City and UEFA, or do you think UEFA might try and push one more time at it, or do you think that's the end of it?
I think, well, UEFA's only option beyond CAS is to go to the Swiss Federal Courts. Historically, they've not been keen to do that. It would also be incredibly expensive process for both UEFA and Manchester City. I don't think UEFA necessarily have the resources or the willpower to do it. Remember, they have suffered significantly as a result of COVID-19, and there are many countries and there are many clubs within Europe who get distributions from UEFA, and they'll be saying to themselves, well, hold on, you know, Manchester City they've won this. Let's just forget this. You're supposed to be paying us out a million euros in respect of getting to the second qualifying round of the Champions League. We want our money now. We don't want that money going into the pockets of lawyers and accountants who will be spending the summer looking at Range Rover brochures.
I mean, it's been suggested, and I've said that was last, but it's been suggested, and I've done a little bit of reading on this, that UEFA could, in effect, dump cash. They're not obliged to, I mean, I know they sign up for them, but, you know, it's basically a voluntary arrangement. It's not like a legal, it's not like a legally enforced thing. They're not mandated, are they? Could we come to a situation where UEFA go, right, we're not going to do that anymore?
That is feasible, but then Manchester City themselves would be in the position to say, well, if you're not going to use the court for arbitration for sport, which is seen as being completely neutral and independent, then we will take up the federal approach. The first thing that we will do is that we will try to get an injunction which would prevent the banning order taking place, or if it does take place, the Champions League cannot take place until this court or until the actual court hearing itself was concluded, which is in nobody's interest. So I think we need to be a little bit cautious. I've seen Tebas's comments with regards to CAS, and he's saying that it's not fit for purpose, but I'm not quite sure on what basis he has reached his conclusion, given that none of us has yet seen the detailed information which formed the basis of the judgment by the panel.
Well, given how 2020 has gone, I'm not ruling anything in or out. I mean, who knew? 1st of January this year, who knew? Kieran, thanks so much for your time. And again, apologies for messing the first recording up. Once again, big thanks to Kieran McGuire of Liverpool University. Thanks for coming back on the show. Let's get back to the studio.
Hi, is that Peter?
It is.
Peter, you've won £21,000 on the football pools.
You're joking.
We're not. You've won 21 grand on the football pools. What will you spend it on?
Seriously? That's amazing. Do you know what? We've only got a bit left on the mortgage.
Well, get it paid off, Peter, and good luck for the next game.
Oh, yeah, I'll be playing at the weekend. This is amazing. Thank you. I can't wait to tell my wife.
This is what winning sounds like. Test your skills. £10 gives you 10 games every month plus 4 free games for new players. And there's £3 million up for grabs this Saturday. Please gamble responsibly. Sign up at footballpools.com/play.
All right, the Reds. This is Connor Phillips, and I'm in the wonderful privileged position to be in, the company of Gav Doyle from LFC Day Trippers. Gav, what's the crack?
Oh, good, Connor. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm sad this week. And we're all sad, sort of collectively sad this week, the last 10 days, that we lost a great man. Now, a great footballer man, a great honorary Irish man, and quite, iconically, a man who gave the chance to a lot of Irish lads who went on to be big Reds. I'm talking, of course, about Jack Charlton, no longer with us. What's your impending memory, your first memory of Jack Charlton?
I was talking to Gibbo before we went live on this, and you come across people in life that, you know, like, they're renegades, or they pick a country up. It could be political, it could be someone from showbiz, or any sort of part of life. But Jack Charlton literally picked Ireland up. I would say he arrived in 86, and he picked us up around 87, 88, and ran with us for close on 10 years. The effect that man had on Ireland as a country, forget football for a minute, as a country, I don't think we'll ever be forgotten, Connor. I'm being honest with you. When he passed away last Friday, I think the news broke on Saturday, and it was just tribute after tribute, and it'll never be enough for him. It will never be enough for him, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah, I'm looking at my last four tweets. I think my last four tweets have been Jack Charlton, Jack Charlton, Jack Charlton, and Jack Charlton. And I'm not a big fan of this whole thing going online and going on Twitter and saying how sad you are if someone's died. You know, I think sometimes people look for a little bit of attention based on someone else's death, but you're absolutely right. Interesting fact, do you know who should have got Big Jack's job when Big Jack got his job?
I believe Paisley was in for it.
Yes, it was. So basically what happened is there was a selection of people in. Billy McNeil was in for it. Bob Paisley, the great Bob Paisley, was in for it. Jack Charlton was in for it. I think some ex-Ireland managers were in for it as well. I think Johnny Giles was back in for the running. Basically what they did was they did a ballot and you had to get to 10 different votes.
Yep.
So I think there was, it was Bob Paisley got to 9 votes. And there was a few other heads around it who got very, very close, but you had to get to 10. So they had to redo the ballot. So obviously football politics took over. A few handshakes were made, a few deals were made. And with Bob Paisley being one vote away from being the Republic of Ireland manager, he ended up falling down the reckoning. And the next vote saw this young fella called Jack Charlton get the Republic of Ireland job. Imagine Bob Paisley taking over that Ireland job. I was going to say it could all have been so different, but part of me wants to say it could all have been so similar.
It could have been, but, and you know, like the great Bob Paisley, as you say, and I have heard that. I think it, I think the way the FAI do it now is like a 3-man panel, and one person has the deciding vote if the other two people don't agree. But yeah, it came down to it. And Jack Charlton is made manager in 1986 for Ireland. And yeah, it could have been also different, but I don't think I'd change it. As much as everyone involved with Liverpool Football Club loves what Bob Paisley was as a man and, you know, what he done for the club, I don't think I'd change it when it comes to the Irish team. You know, like, let's be honest, if you're standing in front of Bob Paisley and Jack Charlton in 1986, there's probably only one winner. But Jack Charlton manages to get the job. And it's mind-blowing to see what he done with this team. Because, like, look at the players he had, Connor. You know, I was looking at it today, and he had players at the peak of their power, and he went and decided to play a certain style of football that right now would be, you know, archaic. But he went and he done it and he stuck to his guns. And what he came away with over a 10-year period is huge. And going back on what you said about, you know, going online and talking about people's deaths, and I'm with you on that to a certain extent. But this crosses eras, doesn't it? This crosses generations. This is us in 2020 talking about a man.
Sorry to interrupt you, Gav, but another important part of Jack Charlton getting the Irish job. Now, this was, like you said, 1985 into 1986. This was the absolute height of the Troubles in Ireland.
Yeah.
This was probably when the biggest distrust of England through Irish eyes ever existed. So the FAI had this decision to make as to how they would take their football team. So they started to recognise a lot of their players were having more influence in England. Liam Brady, Stapleton, I could name quite a few here. So they decided they wanted somebody with an English influence. And, you know, looking back, the fact that he had such an influence when he was brought in as an Englishman, as an English World Cup winner, right?
Yeah.
Which wasn't a massive thing to the Irish people.
Yeah.
Taking over this Irish national team that went so close in their two previous tournaments, so close in 86, in the Euros, between the World Cups and the Euros, between 82, 84, 86.
Yeah.
To hand it over to an Englishman was a big thing.
Huge. Huge, because like you said, you know, Ireland, Northern Ireland, everyone knows the troubles that's gone on there. And like you said, a distrust and a dislike. Let's be honest. Let's be perfectly honest about it. You know, a lot of people in Ireland, I would feel at the time, you know, I'm a very young person at the time when this is happening. But I would have thought that a lot of people in Ireland looking and going, hold on, an Englishman coming in to manage us at football? No. Now, you're right in what you're saying. There was a lot of players that had a lot of influence and they were playing really well at top clubs in England at the time as Irishmen. But you're right, there had to be something there which a lot of people would have looked at and went, this is all wrong. But having said that, it was people probably looking at it and taking politics out of it and taking everything else out of it and looking at it as a footballing thing and saying, no, this man has the charisma, this man has the vision. And listen, he had to do interviews. He didn't turn up and go, I want the job, and he got in the vote. He would have had to do interviews. So they must have looked at it and went, okay, it may be a risky thing to do for in regards to our target audience, which is the Irish people, but let's look outside the circle that we've looked within the past and let's go in a different direction. And it proved to be a massive decision for them.
the politics, like you said there now, it kind of seeped down into bringing the players in as well. I don't mean politics from a political perspective.
Yeah.
I mean politics from a sort of footballing and family history perspective. You yeah. started bringing players in who were second, dare I say, third generation Irish people. But it had already started. Now, John Giles, in fairness to him, previous Ireland manager, Leeds United legend, he had already started this process because he had spent some time in the north of England, started to bring players in. He had an eye on Ray Houghton, I think, and I think he had an eye on John Aldridge, him and Owen Hahn. But then this group of players kind of developed. And this became a big part of what Jack's identity became about. Do you think that was fair, or am I being unfair and any other manager would have done this?
Well, there was loopholes, wasn't there? And those loopholes have continued to today with regards to there's granny rules and all now involved. And you know, you're saying second and third generation, and you could probably go a bit further than that. Look, other managers probably would have done it, you know. But Jack Charlton happened to be in the position as Ireland manager to look at the likes of Ray Houghton, to look at the John Aldridge. You know, there's more there. You know, Tony Cascarino famously tells a story in his book about how, I don't even know if he had an Irish passport. I don't even know if he should have been
the
there.
The story was his adoptive mother was had an Irish passport. And they had to go back into the background of it. And eventually they found out that Cascarino's adoptive mother didn't have Irish passport. So he'd been playing for Ireland for the best part, I think, 6 or 7 years, and he didn't and shouldn't have qualified for them.
No, but he did, and Jack Charlton played him and played him well. So there you go, another string to the big man's bow. But you're right, he uses the rules loosely. I don't know, is that a fair term to say? But he uses them, and like you say, he brings together a team that evolves. I suppose, you know, you could say it evolves over 3 to 4 years, but 88, you're saying they go close, 82, 84, 86, but 88, you're probably thinking, is that a bit early? And but he keeps going and he keeps adding players in. And look, at the end of the day, Jack Charlton came in. He was probably set out targets, and he probably, and most definitely, in my opinion, exceeded them.
He did, and I'll talk about one of, I suppose, my favourite footballing memories outside of supporting the Reds is Italia 90, of course. Ireland come out of this awful group. They had the Dutch from memory. I think they had the Egyptians as well. Yeah. And didn't they have the English? The England. Three teams?
Yeah, so England, Holland and Egypt, yeah.
I think there was it was a one-all draw with Holland. It was a one-all draw with England, and perhaps the worst game of football that any human being has ever watched, in the 0-0 with Egypt. And I think England had a similar result that tournament with them as well.
Well, Ireland get through a tough qualifying group for Italia 90, if you remember. Like, Spain are in there, and Spain are well fancied. Ireland beat them at Lansdowne Road, and that puts them on their way to Italia 90. You know, I think they secure a win away at Malta. I think Aldridge may get both goals in that. But when you get into Italia 90, the country's gone insane. You know, 88 was a warm-up, and they're very lucky in 88. You know, they beat England with that Ray Houghton goal. They draw with the USSR, who were highly rated at the time. Ronnie Whelan, of course, all the Liverpool links here. But Ronnie Whelan scores an outstanding, bicycle kick, as you would call it. Not a bicycle kick, but
almost directly from a throw-in.
Directly from a throw-in, he catches it right in the middle of his shin and it flies into the top corner, and we didn't care. And they're very unlucky to go out of the tournament if you go back and watch the header, it's a mad header goal that spins like you'd see something in cricket, the way the ball spins and goes into the net. I think it's Vim Keefs gets that goal. But Ireland are on their way. And Italia 90, if Germany 88 was one thing, it was only a warm-up to Italia 90. You know, the place goes insane. There isn't a house or a building or any sort of structure in this country that doesn't have some sort of flag or bunting or something hanging over. Cars have everything hanging. There's people hanging out of cars, not just objects.
So fucking tacky. Now, I don't just mean it was tacky because it was 1990.
Yeah.
I mean, because we had never been, like you said, Euro 88, but we'd never been in a World Cup before. So there was this mad scramble for anybody who had any green material to make something green and hang off a building. And it was fucking horrendous looking back, but it's just brilliant.
Yeah, it adds to it. Like, you can still go onto YouTube now and type in Ireland during Italia 90, and it's just insane. And, you know, at this stage, I'm 8 years of age, and I'm, you know, football mad, Liverpool mad, but football mad. And he literally just picked up a country. He literally picked up a country. Yeah. And went, we're going to do this, and you can come with me if you want, or you don't have to. And everybody went, oh, well, we're going, because half of Ireland, I think, ended up going to Italy. It was crazy, you know. But the group we had was tough. England were highly rated. The Dutch are always highly rated, and Egypt were a little bit unknown in world footballing terms, you know. But we draw with England. Lineker puts them ahead. Kevin Sheedy equalises. We go behind for a Ruud Gullit goal against Holland, but Tony Cascarino. Noel Quinn equalises.
Again, an absolutely awful goal. Goalkeeper was an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
I remember where I was when it happened.
Yeah, it was insane. And the Egypt one was nil all draw. Egypt literally put every man behind the ball, and Ireland just kept doing what Ireland do. And that's just keep putting her in the box and see what happens.
So here, and I'm just on that. Actually, sorry to contradict you a wee bit here. That game against Egypt, right, and it was the one that was famously, there's an Irish commentator, if you don't know, or an Irish pundit called Eamon Dunphy. He said he was as disgraced to be Irish after this,
yeah,
because we had such highs in years gone by. Paddy Bonner, from my wee bit of research I've done, who was the Ireland goalkeeper at the time, had the ball in his hands. This was pre-back pass rule. Had the ball in his hands for in and around 6 minutes in that Egypt game.
It's,
right?
It's mental. So it's absolutely mental.
This game was a catalyst. Now, not the only reason, you know, you could say Frank Lampard putting the ball over the line in one of the World Cups there recently is the catalyst for why we have goal line technology now. But as much as that, they reckon that Bonner game, or that Egypt game, when Bonner had the ball in his hand for 6 minutes, back pass, pick it up, that was one of the catalysts for why we have the back pass rule in the game now.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, because the back pass rule, you know, I think the back pass rule disappears. Is 1992 the last competition where the back pass rule is in, and then it disappears? Or maybe it's the first competition, Euro 92, where the back pass rule is gone, and you can't pass it back and pick it up. But it was an awful game. And, you know, as many highs as there've been as an Ireland fan, I suppose, during them 10 years of Charlton's tenure, this one was just... You know, if there was ever a game to burst the bubble, this was it, because it was just horrendous from start to finish. And I don't know what Egypt were trying to get over. I don't know what Ireland were trying to get over, because, you know, I think it was the second game in the group. So it wasn't like it was telling where, you know, take a draw here, lads, and see where we go. Like, it was a bit of a strange one. But yeah, listen, you're saying it's not the only reason for the back pass being abolished. But you could have put that game forward as the only reason to do it, and you probably would have passed it on that basis.
Yeah, but then there was, I think, probably, right, let's take Istanbul out of it. Probably let's take corner taken quickly out of it. I think my favourite game of all time is the Romania game. Not necessarily the game, it's the penalty shootout, it's... The lad who became my hero, I was and still am occasionally a goalkeeper, and that's Paddy Bonner. Tell me about what was then the greatest day in Irish sport.
Yeah, it has to go down as one of them, doesn't it? And no matter what sport you view, you know, there'd be people out there that will argue for Ireland winning Six Nations in rugby and stuff like that. But this, for me, will still go down as the greatest day in Irish sport and history. You know, again, you have Jack Charlton, who's exceeding expectations. He's on the crest of a wave. The whole country behind him, you know, everybody is just glued to televisions wherever they can find it. And he has this team that, you know, you've mentioned Eamon Dunphy. Like, Jack Charlton is the making of Eamon Dunphy, because Eamon Dunphy famously has a go at Jack Charlton, I think, in the run up to this tournament, and basically tells him to get out of a press conference, and Dunphy ends up on RT television in Ireland and has been there, and I don't know if he still is. If he's not, he's only left over the last couple of years. But it's the making of Eamon Dunphy is the interaction he has with Jack Charlton prior to this tournament. But that day itself, you know, as an 8 year old, that the nerves is huge. You know the whole country is watching this, and we're going up against Romania, who of course has Hagi in their team, and you're thinking this fella's a bit special. And it goes, you know, the game goes on, it's nil all, the extra time. Genoa is packed with Irish people, and you're going, you know, the way a little country like Ireland, we're going to get done on penalties here, aren't we? That's the feeling, because when does this happen to small nations, you know, on the world football stage? But like you said, Bonner goes the right way for every penalty. He goes the right way for every penalty, and he manages to save one from Tomofte, I think it is. He saves it from.
He knows the pub, and his pub is called Penalty, to try and get him over the gym.
No way.
It was held against him for years. He has a pub called Penalty.
Seriously? That's one of the best facts I've ever heard.
It's in, and it means that it was his way of dealing with it. But anyway, we'll move on a bit quicker because there's so much to get through in a couple of minutes here. That was massive. Ireland go on to play Italy after the Paddy Bonner save. Just very, very quickly, because we'll jump into the next World Cup as well here. Very quickly, that save, when Paddy Bonner saved that, do you remember where you were?
Yes, I was in my cousin's house. They lived about 15 doors from me. And just as he went to take the penalty, the cable came out of the back of the television and all I could see was static. And three or four of us were in the room because we were too young to be in a pub. So everybody left us with an older cousin. They were trying to mind us. The cable comes out of the back of the television. We don't know what happens. We scramble towards the television, nearly knock it over, put the cable back in, and just in time for Paddy Bonner to be jumping around him. We know, well, he must have saved it. You don't react like that if someone scored a penalty on you.
Well, look, there was heartbreak against Italy then after that. Paddy Bonner didn't cover himself in glory for a few games after that. But then it builds on. They don't qualify for the Euros in 1992. Nope. They had a very successful campaign in that, but a couple of really bad results towards the end of it. But 1994, again, Jack Charlton and what he did, again, using roughly the same team, give or take a few players. He wasn't a big man for blooding new players. He was playing this rigid 4-4-2 system, get the ball up to the corner, it'd be whipped in for the likes of Niall Quinn, Cascarino, Aldridge to pop it in. But it worked again.
It did. And we end up in a group with Italy, Mexico and Norway. And the big thing going to America was, we're going to have a huge following again. But the likes of Orlando may kill us. You know, Steve Staunton is going around with, you know, hats on him. I think he's asking to play the games in hats.
Fitting hat on earth.
Yeah, I think Tommy Coyne starts the game up front, if I remember rightly, against Italy, and he literally has sunstroke when he comes off. He's exhausted and he can't give a urine sample because there's no fluid left in his body, and it's not his fault, but that's the rules. And of course Ray Houghton pops up and scores that goal over Pagliuca. But the big thing out of that one was Paul McGrath and a young Phil Babb beside him. But again, Ireland torn up, massive support, underdogs, score a goal, defend for their lives, and it's party time again. Here we go.
It is, and it was we didn't go just as far as the World Cup, but Big Jack and John Aldridge, let's bring back the Ireland Liverpool link if we can.
I know where you're going with this.
Memorable confrontations, not only from an Irish or a Scouse perspective, but in the history of any World Cup ever. Every time you see a sort of an amalgamation of clips from World Cups, montages, there's Big Jack wagging the finger saying, get my fucking player on that pitch now.
Yeah, and you know what? You mentioned that now, and I knew where you were going with it. And I seen a clip on it the other day. I think it might have been a documentary that was done on, believe it or not, I think it was the History Channel. It was like a sport one that they'd done. And John Aldridge is talking about it. And the big issue they have is, there's a guy on the side of the pitch that's meant to take down the notes and give the subs out. And this FIFA guy appears from nowhere and decides the sub's not happening. And the Irish player has left the pitch. So John Aldridge is looking to come on, not realising cameras and mics are literally turned on right beside him, and has a meltdown. Jack Charlton has a meltdown, and apparently Jack Charlton gets fined and banned for the next game and never told why he's banned, but it will go down as one of the best moments of a World Cup ever, because it's against Mexico, we get beaten, but it's one of those where there's no doubt the whole country is up at the television going, yeah, you fucking tell him, you know. And I don't even know if we're allowed to swear on this, but I've done it. But It's one of those things where, look, Jack is definitely one of us now. Look at this. You know, he's not having, he doesn't care if it's FIFA or anybody around him. He's telling them what way it should be done. And Aldridge eventually gets on the pitch.
There was a slight irony with that game, I thought, because it was 12 o'clock in the day, from memory, that had to happen, right? And like Steve Stallman, two Irish gingers, right? Out in 95 degree heat with hats on them trying to play football. Because they couldn't do what people have compared Klopp and Jack Charlton a lot in the last couple of weeks, because of the gegenpressing, or as we called it in Ireland, put them under pressure, right? Yep. A lot of people laughed at it for years, but it has kind of filtered down into football. Ireland couldn't really play that style because it was so hot. It was actually weird that Mexico game, Ireland played some of the best football under Jack Charlton. Even the John Aldridge goal that day showed that Jack had a little bit of nous about him, but he played to his strengths.
Yeah, he did. And when you look at the players he had, he the football you describe, it, obviously it was a bit more of a keep ball thing, you know, try conserve some energy in what was a ridiculous heat in Orlando that day. I think it was Orlando. But like you said, they had to get the ball down and play it and reduce the amount of output from themselves in order to last 90 minutes, because genuinely, Steve Staunton was getting sunstroke every time he stepped outside of a room. You know, it was ridiculous. Players were breaking down with, you know, just exhaustion, heat exhaustion from the weather that was there. And they do play good football. But Jack Charlton, when you look at it, he has, like you look, he has Aldridge, he has McGrath, he has Whelan, he has Helton, all brilliant footballers, but he plays a certain way and he doesn't veer from that. That's his way and he's going to do it. And a lot of people criticised him in, you know, further down the line. It was horrible football to watch. It was successful. And there's so many managers out there that have been successful with not the sort of football you want to see, but they're successful. And that's all that matters. But yeah, he played good football that day. And I think the goal Aldridge gets is key in qualifying from the group, because the goal scored is what gets us through.
Yeah, it is. Let me just talk you through some of these if we can, because I know we're here on the Anfield Wrap, just very quickly. Some of the Reds who made a massive influence in the Ireland setup for him. And then I always thought that because Ireland, you had to work incredibly hard to play for Ireland. I think a lot of players really wanted to be there. There was no not turning up for international duty. They fought to be there. And it kind of, it ended up sort of complementing their club career. So I've got Ray Houghton, Ronnie Whelan, Mark Lawrenson, John Aldridge, Steve Staunton, Jason McAteer, Jim Beglin, Kevin Sheedy, although he played for a different club for a while, and Phil Babb as well. Am I missing anyone?
No, I don't think you are. I think you have a good list of people there. And but again, when you look at them, they're at their peak or in around their peak when Jack gets hold of them. You know, well, Jason McAteer, obviously not. He's very young in 94. He's still with Bolton, I think. He ends up getting the move to Liverpool the following year in the summer of 95, I think. But they're in their peak. And that, look, if you take Helton, you take Staunton, you take Whelan, and you take Aldridge, who were in around the Liverpool side during that time, and the Liverpool side that play really, really, really good football, and then they go over to Ireland and they're on the points and they're, you know, kicking it as far up that way as you can and then try to get it back and try to score goals. It's alien to them in their club game, and from club to international it's alien, but it works. And that's the power of the man, because we talk so much about getting buy-in, players having, managers getting buy-in from players. That fella turns up and turns their footballing world upside down and they buy it every single day of the week. That's the biggest thing for me with Jack Charlton.
88, Ray Houghton scores a header against England. I think that set the scene for how Irish football was going to be for probably the generation that comes after it. So there's that goal. There is also Paddy Bonner save. There's the Houghton goal against Italy. There's the qualifying for both tournaments. There is the row on the side of the pitch. Listen, I could go on and on and on about the big things that Jack had an influence over Irish football. Which one is the one that makes you, I suppose, tops the tree for you with Jack's passing over the last couple of weeks? Which one really makes you go, yeah, that was the one?
You've mentioned a few. There's probably a few more there in amongst all that. You know, one of my favourite moments is Jack Charlton coming home after 1990 to, I think it's College Green in Dublin City Centre, and he does a speech and everyone's hanging on every word he says. Every word he says, they hang on it. And he knows, they talk about him being an honorary Irishman. I just consider him Irish. That's what I do. And I wouldn't see many people out there arguing with me over it. But the Romanian one is the one. And it's not only the Paddy Bonner save, the O'Leary goal, you know, the reaction. But there's a little clip of him standing, you know, just as the penalties are about to be taken. And he has his hand up against his chin. And he's leaning against the subs bench, you know. And you can see him physically shaking. You know, that's how much it means to him. He's physically shaking in his body. He can't keep his hands still. He can't compose himself, because that's how much it means to him to manage another country to what will go down as, you know, the greatest day in footballing, in Irish footballing history. So for me, that's the day. But there's so many more around it, and there's so many more things about the man that is there to be admired and will be missed.
Yeah, but we don't know things like, and we don't remember things like he managed a Middlesbrough side to promotion with, they were champions with seven games to spare, which sounds relatively comfortable for us to say on the podcast. It could have been Bob Paisley who was the manager, but it wasn't. It was Jack Charlton. And a lovely story I heard during the week, and it was the first time I've ever heard this story actually, in World Cup 1990. It was the weirdest thing. You know, you've got the Pope. He's up doing his Pope thing in the Vatican, and you look up the front and there's 20 lads in the worst tracksuits, shell suits you have ever seen in your life. And the Pope goes, ah, look at the Irish team. They hit as well. And they ended up going to meet the Pope. And obviously, Paddy Bonner, he didn't cover himself with glory in the end of that tournament when he gave away a goal to what was Toto Scalacci. If you get a chance to Google Toto Scalacci now at the moment, the worst hair transplant you've ever seen in your life. But he scores this goal. He becomes a hero. And then subsequently, during or just after that little gathering of people in Dublin, I think it was after the game, he was sitting there with a fag and they were talking about, well, it was a great World Cup, we met the Pope, and he turned around and he goes, do you know what, Paddy, yeah, the fucking Pope could have saved that one. Do you know, it was one of those, he was that kind of personality. He's going to be missed, and there's never going to be another one like him, Gab, is there?
No. The way Irish football is at the moment, on an international level, it'll be hard to see them qualifying before anything else. They're not in the best of shape at the moment, the FAI. It's been well documented. There may be someone that comes along and is more successful than Jack Charlton in terms of getting to tournaments and progressing, but there'll never be a person that changed the landscape of Irish football like Jack Charlton, in my opinion, ever, because he took them from obscurity a little bit, also ran and turned them into genuinely one of the most feared football, international football teams in the world over a period of probably 5 to 6 years during that 10-year period. He's going to be hugely missed as a man, as a manager. And, you know, there's a certain generation in Ireland that will always remember the man till their dying day. And that's only fair, I think.
Gav Doyle from LFC Day Trippers, Ivan Connor Phillips. And just one thing we have to be careful of, as we remember Jack Charlton as the former Republic of Ireland manager, it won't be long until the English try and claim him.
It's John Gibbons from the Anfield Wrap with a message to our free listeners. So those of you who don't currently subscribe to the Anfield Wrap, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to ask you a few questions on your experience listening to these free shows or watching the free videos or anything that you currently do to connect with the Anfield Wrap. For subscribers, for those who do pay, don't worry. There'll be a survey coming at you soon. But this is just for the free listeners at the moment. So if you go to theanfieldwrap.com/survey, that's theanfieldwrap.com/survey, and it'll just take you about 10 minutes, but it'll be really interesting for us to get your feedback on the work that we're doing at the moment. So yeah, thanks very much. If you've got any questions, you can give us a shout, but theanfieldwrap.com/survey, let us know what you think. And as I say, to reiterate, this is for our free listeners only. If you do subscribe, currently subscribe to the Anfield Wrap, first of all, thank you, and secondly, you'll be getting your own survey soon, don't worry.
Thanks to Connor Phillips there with Gav and Steve talking about Jack Charlton. A lovely little segment there for the weekend. And obviously Liverpool aren't playing this weekend, so we're just going to get stuck into the transfer window. The news come out this week that the transfer window is going to be open till October. And I just want to sort of get your views on what you think this means for us, what it means for the league. Obviously, nobody knows when the league's even going to start at the moment. Nobody knows what the money situation is for any clubs. It's all a bit up in the air, isn't it, Craig? It's what did you make when you first heard the news? Did it make you think of anything to do with like us and Liverpool? Whether that would like, I don't know, will it make it more likely for us to sign someone, the fact that it's going to run that late? Or
I think so. I think that we know that Liverpool won't take any risks because they're continually saying it. Journalists are continually coming out saying there won't be big signings and stuff this summer. I think as soon as Liverpool know when fans are going to be in the ground or when things are going to be more normal or how much they're going to get from the TV money, I think you might sort of see a change in their tact and their strategy. And you know, they'll have these players lined up because they would have had them lined up 6 months ago. The amount that they sort of look to spend and want to spend might change, and maybe you might look to be a little bit smart with some, whether it's younger players or loans or whatever. I think it's just going to be a strange transfer window this year, just because of because of everything that's going on, not just the pandemic, but the way the fixtures have moved, the just everything around football has sort of changed, and the landscape's changed for transfers. I mean, like as a Liverpool fan, I want to see Liverpool make big signings that'll improve the side. But what's sort of coming out is that they won't be doing that. And you know, I remember us doing shows this time last year and talking about building from a position of strength, and we didn't really do that, but it's worked out okay. I think that's the one thing. I sort of caveat everything in saying that, you know, we can trust Jurgen Klopp, and, you know, we've seen that the strategy's worked and so on and so on. But I mean, I still want new faces in. What I would say is that I think we're in a much better position than Man City, and that Man City are going to be losing the likes of Silva and I think Fernandinho. And so they're going to have to bring new players in. And when new players come in, it's a risk, or it's it's, they've lost Sané as well. It's a time for sort of adapting to the league, while hopefully we can just sort of, straight from the off. I don't see any sort of transfers being first 11, because that's a very, very difficult thing to try and improve. But I would really like to see someone better than bringing on Divock Origi. Or that he was burning my head out last night, and so I'd love to be able to look to the bench and think, well, there's Keita there, that's a brilliant sub, but there's one more striker there that can really sort of make a difference.
I mean, Kev, it sounded like one of your kids didn't agree with Keita, and that's all I'm gonna say.
That's all I'll be saying. Shut up, Keita.
Yeah, shut up and leave Divock alone. It's a tough one, isn't it, Kev? Because obviously the transfer window changed, didn't it? Which meant that it was closing before the season started, because it was always rumbling on, weren't it, into the first couple of weeks, and then it changed, so it was finished by the time the season starts. But then if you're looking at this going into October, it looks like that's going to happen again. And I think with the fact that we don't know how next season is going to look, like Craig says, we don't know when people are going to get back into the ground. We don't know when people are going to start spending that money again, and we know that these clubs, especially Liverpool, are £1 billion companies. But there's the likes of other teams in the league. I mean, the first one that comes to my head was Bournemouth, even though I think they're going to be relegated. But let's just say, like, someone like a Bournemouth, who do rely on that that income to come in. And without that source of money for a lot of clubs, it's going to be hard for them to make these signings, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the thing with the clubs like Bournemouth and that, they're probably... they rely more on television money than they do for the stadium stuff. So they got bankrolled up through the league. So I'm not sure it's going to be... my feelings on this is I'm proper through a Liverpool prism on it. And I'm proper through a prism that says, FSG, listen, I'm going to get stick for this, but I don't like them personally. I know we've won the league, we've won the European Cup, and they've given everything that we needed to do that. But the problem is, now we're at a point where they bought a club for 300 million quid or whatever it was that was going into administration. The club's probably worth 2 billion now, 2.5 billion quid. So they've made £2 billion on that when they eventually sell. And they've made no bones about the fact that they will eventually sell. This, for me, should be the time where they say, okay, well, listen, what we'll do is we'll mortgage some of that 2 billion quid and we'll back the manager now. For us to turn someone like Timo Werner down for 50 million quid, because we don't know when fans are going to be back in the ground, says to me that what they're trying to do is run the club on a total shoestring. And I think Klopp, when he came out the other day and said it's going to be very difficult without real money to make the signings, was, I don't know whether it was the first rumblings of discontent as such, because I don't know whether Klopp might just come out and say, listen, I was pissed off, if that was something that he wanted to say. But clubs like Liverpool are going to miss out more through match day revenue, because we've got bigger stadiums. So You can understand why the theory behind why they're doing it. But when you think about the equity they've built up in the club over the last 10 years, it's madness to me that we're not at the point of being the best team in the world. We're not looking at this as... this should be an opportunity for Liverpool, not a threat, in my opinion. We should be looking and going, well, we can probably pick some real bargains up here if we just flex our muscles a little tiny bit. But instead, it looks like Liverpool... And I might be proved wrong over the summer, and I really hope that I am. But it looks like Liverpool are going to say, well, we're just going to hold our cards where we are and see where we land up. The problem is, we've done that last summer as well, and we haven't refreshed this squad. And the squad is absolutely fantastic, but every single great team that went through a dynasty always refreshed. Some teams were literally ripped apart and rebuilt. Shankly done that with his first Liverpool team. He took that apart and built a new Liverpool team. Alex Ferguson's done it 3 or 4 times at Man United. And Liverpool need to be very, very wary of thinking, well, we'll just hold what we've got now. Because if someone else takes a swing and it looks like Chelsea are taking a bit of a swing and gets it right, it's another competitor for us to have to deal with. And we're having to deal with it, not from a standing start, because we're the best team in the world at the moment. But next year, we may have found a few more issues. And as Craig said, listen, David Origi is a Liverpool legend. There's no doubt about it. But let's have it right. He's fucking shite at football. He's boss at scoring goals, but he's shite at football. He hasn't put a good performance in. Honestly, he drives me fucking mad. He's great at scoring goals, and I love him. So I know that sounds terrible. I hope he's not listening, because I'd hate to break to hear his feelings, because he seems such a lovely fella. But his performance in the European Cup final was a joke. He couldn't hit the ball 10 yards to one of the Liverpool shirts. And he come on last night, and when he fouled that lad in the box at the end, I'd have happily strangled him. I really would have. What a dickhead. What's he doing there? We need to get rid of players like that. Shaqiri's going to go, sound happy days, let's get rid of him. We need to be looking at people like Timo Werner for half of his value in a normal transfer window is over 100 million quid, because there'd be so many clubs that were willing to buy him, and so there's been a bidding war for him. He wants to come to Liverpool for 50 million quid and we're saying no because we don't know what we're going to have to do. Well, next year when people are back in the grounds, if the football transfer market goes back to what it was a couple of years ago, Timo Werner for 50 million quid is going to look like the biggest steal the football world has ever seen, and we're probably going to have to pay double that for somebody else. Now listen, I hope, as I say, I'm proved wrong, and I hope this is all just a bit of the throwing a bit of toffee out there to clubs because they want people to think, oh, Liverpool are skint and we're going to try and undercut and we're going to try and get good value in the market. But I fear that we're not doing that, and especially with Jurgen Klopp coming out and saying it. But yeah, it's this summer's big for Liverpool, and I think if we just sit on our hands, we will be better.
I mean, Cam, do you think that's got a lot to do with as well Man City? So obviously they've won the case, they're going to be in Europe, they've lost out on the league, we don't know what's going to happen with the Champions League with them, but they won't have liked missing out in the way that they have. They won't have liked being, you know, at one point, what was it, like 23 points behind Liverpool. They're going to probably go, well, they are going to go and spend big because that's what Man City do. Do you think, obviously, we go head-to-head with them in the league, but the fact that we do have an eye on Man City makes us a little bit more wary about what we do?
Yeah, exactly. It should be them looking at us. Like, anyone can say, like, the money's not going to be there for any, but let's be honest, with them City owners, the money's there for them regardless of what's going on. They're going to be spending this summer. Chelsea, obviously, that transfer ban like last year, like whatever's happened with them, that seems to be the best thing that could happen, because this year that means they have been allowed to spend, like you've seen with Timo Werner. But with us, I just don't wonder where we'll sat in a year or two looking at, oh, well, we came third or something and we just dropped off, because we're literally now in the position of a lifetime to us. Like, we could go on and just conquer for absolutely years if we play our cards right. Yeah, it could be a calculated risk, but as Kev said, like, this is what we did last year. Like, there's only so many times you can just go along on a shoestring and Klopp performing wonders, where before you know it, he comes out in an interview and just spits the dummy out sort of thing and just has a go with the owners. Because I could see Klopp being that type of fella where if he didn't get the backing and it just got too much, he'd just come out and say it as it is. I could just see that. And obviously nobody wants that to happen. Nobody wants it to go back to the Rafa and Hicks and Gillette days where all stuff like that. Nobody wants to go back to anything like that. But City should be looking at us and seeing how we're going to strengthen. It shouldn't be us looking at them. And as I said, the market's going to be changing so much this year. You could end up getting a few steals. It's all just a catalyst effect, isn't it? Like, what's going to happen? Will clubs be able to get some of our players, some of our deadwood, like, you know, fans being allowed in the ground? But like as we said, the owners, they've made enough money off us in the last few years now. Surely there's some sort of money there for us to go out and spend on one or two decent players. I'm not saying about putting Salah or Mane out the team because they're irreplaceable. It's about bringing in bench players, as you said, in games like that last night, where you can look to the bench and there's a match winner there, and that's what we need.
Yeah, I think Cam's right there. I mean, I agree with what Cam says, Claire, just looking at the bench from last night, and it was Lovren, Keita, Adrian, Minamino, Shaqiri, Origi, Curtis Jones, Harvey Elliott, Nico Williams. Now, that isn't a bench we'd... And I don't mean it as a slight on any of the lads at all, but we've built ourselves up to this side, which we do claim is the best in the world, and rightfully so, because we are champions of England, champions of Europe, and actually the champions of the world. We should have, you know, better names than that. And I think it's more to do with circumstances, isn't it? And I know we like to try and foresee everything, and we talk about what if so-and-so gets injured and stuff, but that's just us wanting to carry on what we've built. I mean, without that last night, obviously Adam Alana's going to go. We're looking at Jordan Henderson was injured, James Milner's injured, Joel Matip's injured. Like, there's a good couple of players there already that you're missing. But it does show that we probably do need a little bit more depth, a little bit of something that, you know, in situations like last night, that we can bring somebody on who really can change a game, who's not as much of a drop-off as, say, Divock Origi is to the front three.
Yeah, I agree with everything that everyone said, but I feel like the hardest thing is that, obviously, it's money, isn't it? City are prepared to throw a ridiculous amount of money at a left-back who is quite happy to sit on a bench. And that's the balance, is we can... And that's what Jürgen always says, doesn't he? He wants people to join the journey. He doesn't want someone to just come up at the end of a party. And to me, it's that fine balance of finding, you know, I know what you're saying about Divock Origi. He isn't great. He is a legend, but he's prepared to sit there and wait. You know, would Timo Werner have been prepared to sit on that bench and wait to get his chance? I honestly don't know. I think the Man City thing, that them winning that case, might play into our hands. Our owners might look at that and think, do you know what, we've been following the rules and actually we're just going to start throwing some money at this now. Not by breaking rules, but as in just maybe changing the way that we do it. For me, you know, I think Joel Matip's obviously didn't cost us anything. He's great. Do we keep Dejan Lovren every time his name appears on a team sheet? I've got, you know, heart attack moments all over the place. But as well, I think, like, next season, we've got to stay in all the competitions for as long as possible to give the likes of Curtis Jones, Harvey Elliott. Yeah, they've done really well and they probably don't come on with much expectation, but they need more and more game time to turn them into, that you look at the bench and don't go, oh, there's three kids there. You look at it and think, they're like Trent Alexander, they're like Andy Robertson. They're good first team players, and that's what I think Klopp can do, which, you know, Pep's a great manager, don't get me wrong, but I don't think he instills the same team mentality that we do. You know, Salah doesn't play against Barcelona, Bobby doesn't play against Barcelona, no problem. That's team mentality. You can have 11 £200 million players on the bench, but if you don't all work together, you don't win anything, as proven, games lost.
I think people have often said about the idea that it's difficult to bring in someone for the front three because the front three is so good. And I sort of feel that's kind of bollocks, in that if you're a footballer of a certain of that quality, you'll come into Liverpool, you'll sign for Liverpool believing that you're good enough to dethrone one of the three. So you'll come into the club and go, well, you know, it might take me 10 games, but after that, I'll be starting ahead of Bobby Firmino, for instance, because he doesn't go to Anfield. Or, you know, you'll be finding reasons. And I think that that's the sort of player that you, as a fan, we want to sort of bring in and have to come on the bench at the beginning. And then suddenly there is this conversation around the four. Well, who is it? Who is it in this game out of the three? And then the opposition's trying to work out who it'll be. And your game changes because it's not Firmino, it's this other player. And I think as well, like, you know, you can talk about how successful this team have been and sort of rest on those laurels. But those players will want better players to come in as well, because they'll want better chances of winning things in the future. And they'll want more competition, because they'll believe, like Mane, Salah, and Firmino will all believe, well, you can sign anyone you like, but they'll not come in, they'll not replace me because I'm brilliant. And suddenly there becomes this like sort of healthy competition that I think you've seen between Salah and Mane over the past couple of years. They both want to score more than each other. They both want to be better than each other, but they both respect each other and they work well with each other in the team. And I think that's something that Liverpool need to get right, where it's not looking to the bench and it's seven players all on a particular level, that it's, you know, it's five or six and then there's this one that's an absolute belter that's, you know, that should maybe be in the first team more often.
Do you know what
biggest regret?
Do you know, I don't even think Ings is good enough, you know. Someone like Timo Werner, like, I keep banging on about him and listen, egg on my face next year if he's like a Shevchenko down at Chelsea, but I don't think he's going to be. But if you play 60 games a season on average, yeah, and you've got three starting places, that means if you've got four strikers, each of them can start 45 games with a rolling move for someone who doesn't start. That's only 15 games a season where they don't start. That's a lot of starts for any striker to get. And as Craig just said there, you bring anyone of Timo Werner's level in, all you're going to do with the other three is increase their level, because they're like, well, I'm not getting dropped for him. He might be better than you, Bobby, but he's not better than me. That's the type of healthy competition we want, and that's the type of the games yesterday. Listen, yesterday's an anomaly because we've already won the league, but in games where you need to get an extra point, like United away this season, probably a good example of it. A game like that, if you can bring Timo Werner on, you're not looking at a 1-1, you're looking at a 2-1, and that's the difference. And for £50 million, someone like him, he's an absolute steal. And that's what makes me worry about the future. If FSG are penny pinching that much at the moment and we're that short on cash when we've increased our value fivefold since they bought us.
We've also had to sort of not compete in the cups to achieve what we've achieved the last two seasons. Yeah. Like, we've effectively just said that we're not asked about them. And I think, like, I'd like to think that'll change now because, you know, Klopp's done the two things that he knew when he came in, that those are the main objectives, that's how you become a legend at this club. But he's also talked about the idea of this football team winning so many trophies that they can't remember which ones they won when and so on. And if you're going to do that, then you have to start competing in the cups and winning the cups. And to do that, you need a bigger squad. You need a better squad with more quality that isn't putting Divock Origi in. And he maybe scores one here, but then the next three games he's shite. You know, it's you know, obviously you want to blood the youngsters and you don't want to sort of create or block a pathway for someone like Brewster. But then also, you know, it is like we found out at the beginning of last season, it's a big ass to ask someone as young as Rayan Brewster to come in and be that fourth striker. Even if he is scoring one and two in the championship, it's a big sort of gap and there still is that gulf in quality, even though he is a young age. So I think what we're saying is we want Liverpool to give themselves the best possible chance and the best opportunity of winning as much as they can at a time whenever they're at their absolute peak. And to do that, you need new players coming in.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, like, we'll just wrap it up there because, like, it's funny, isn't it? We're saying at the top of the show, don't worry in this and the other, and then and now we're worrying. But let's be honest, that we all shared a common goal here. We just want Liverpool to be as good as they can be, and there's no hard feelings involved. But like I say, just remember who they are and what they've done for us. We're champions of England. You know, we could be in a much worse position than what we are. Thank you so much to Claire, to Cam, to Craig and to Kev, all the kids today, for joining me on the weekend. So thanks to Connor, Gav and Steve for the Jack Charlton segment, and Andy and Kieran Maguire for the City stuff. That has been your weekender. And the next time you get to see Liverpool play, they will be lifting that Premier League trophy. Have a good weekend. Sports Social Podcast Network.